Bonsoir. Bonsoir tout le monde. Je m'appelle Sylvie Deblois et je suis professeure à l'École d'environnement de l'Université McGill. C'est avec beaucoup de plaisir qu'on vous reçoit tous ce soir à l'École d'environnement pour entendre notre invité, Andrew Refkin. Bonsoir, Andrew.
Great to be here.
Et avec lui, on va s'interroger sur la meilleure voie à suivre pour aborder les grandes questions environnementales de notre époque, une époque qu'il qualifie lui-même de turbulente, et je pense qu'on peut être d'accord avec ce qualificatif. So, what is that saying again? Challenges make life interesting, but overcoming them makes life meaningful? Or something along these lines. Most of us, when faced with personal challenges, gain strength from the supports of others. At the McGill School of Environment, we think that facing the increasingly complex challenges of the 21st century requires bold approaches. Our mission is simple. It's to bring great minds together, minds like yours, like Andrew Refkin's here. This means also in our program creating fertile ground for collaborative learning and research at the interface of disciplines. And this means inspiring students and networks of collaborators with the vision of a sustainable future and then working together towards that vision. This means supporting each other. So it's also thanks to the support of people like you and to the support in particular of a generous donor that we are able at McGill to invite people like Andrew here. I will say no more about our guest speaker, but I will let Professor Elena Bennett, one of our professors also at the School of Environment, and also a co-author of a recently published paper on planetary boundaries in science, introduce our guest. Bonne soirée à tous. Merci d'être ici.
Thanks, Sylvie. So it's my pleasure to get to welcome you all here to the annual McGill School of Environment public lecture. I was just told this is our 14th annual public lecture, quite a long history of doing this. So tonight we're going to have a lecture given to us by Andrew Refkin, and that's going to be followed by a question and answer period that I will come up and moderate, and I will remind you then, but I'm going to say it now anyway. Please use the microphone so that we can get you your questions recorded. Thanks. So back to my welcoming duty. So Andrew Refkin, who's going to speak to us tonight, is a senior fellow for environmental understanding at Pace University, and he's a prize-winning journalist. He's written for Discover magazine, for Science Digest, for the New York Times. And as a writer doing this, he's won many of the top awards in science journalism multiple times, including Joint National Academies Communication Award and a Guggenheim Fellowship for demonstrating exceptional capacity for productive scholarship or exceptional creative ability in the arts. From 1995 through 2009, he covered the environment for the Times as a staff reporter. That's a quarter century of coverage of global warming primarily, and that earned him many major awards for science journalism and the John Chancellor Award for Sustained Journalistic Excellence that was awarded from Columbia University. Andrew has also been a pioneer in multimedia communication. He's blogging and shooting both still and video imagery all around the world. And at Pace, he teaches courses in blogging and environmental communications and in documentary filmmaking. And he also writes the New York Times op-ed blog.earth, where I spend a considerable amount of time. And it's one of the top 25 blogs in 2013. It's one of my favorite sites to spend time on because it often causes me to read and then stop and then think and then think some more and think a little differently about Earth and about the human place on Earth. So tonight, Andrew's going to speak to us about charting a good path in a turbulent age, which is a fresh approach to fostering durable progress on complex, turbulent planets. So one focused less on setting unachievable goals and more about fostering personal and community traits that give the best odds of positive environmental and social outcomes, something I know that speaks to many in this global environment and I'm sure to many of us in this room. So I hope you will join me in welcoming Andrew Revkin. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Thank you. It's great to be here. It's great to be back in Montreal. I've been here a few times. I was here 11 years ago to write about the movie The Day After Tomorrow, you know, the movie about the ice age sparked by global warming, which was filmed mostly right here on those big sound stages somewhere outside of town. It was a bizarre experience. It was also very cold here when I came here. But I've been back a couple times. But it's a pleasure to be here on the campus. I've met a number of the faculty and some students yesterday, and we had some great discussions about how to move forward with getting progress on environmental issues in a very complicated era, when so many things are interlaced in ways that that are really fundamentally different than some of the problems we dealt with successfully in the last century. So that's going to be the key for me going forward. I'm going to show you in this talk, it'll be my learning curve. This is my 30th. This is actually just for the human relationship to the climate system. This is my 30th anniversary writing about that. And I'm going to pass this around. Handle it gently. It's an artifact. This is an actual paper. See, it's made of paper. It's a thing called a magazine. And it was my first article about climate change. It was about nuclear war. The idea that if we incinerated enough cities, we would end up with a nuclear winter because there'd be so much schmutz in the atmosphere, kind of like geoengineering. But in an involuntary way. And I'm going to talk about that in a few minutes, but just pass that around and you can see what journalism used to be like. And so that was 1985. But I want to start by just sort of digging in on this idea of the Anthropocene. This is a piece of art by Robin Wollstone, who's a British sort of a conceptual artist. She did this is based on a sign. The Las Vegas, Welcome to Las Vegas sign. And obviously it has all kinds of ironies attached to it. But I think it's a very useful introduction to this question of can we have a good path in the age of us? And a lot of my colleagues, other journalists and commentators like Clive Hamilton in Australia reject that idea completely. I'm sure there's more than a few people in the room who think it's impossible. Essentially, when you look at extinction rates and what we're doing to the atmosphere, how could you possibly call that anything about that good? Elaine is involved with research along these lines too. So what do you do? And it's not a Pollyanna-ish thing to examine that question, because good, the word good, first of all, is not scientific. The word good is from the humanities, from philosophy. Good is a values judgment. What is good? So implicitly, I think by discussing a good path in the Anthropocene, we're talking about the intersection of values and data. And I think we have to get comfortable with the idea that not everything will be determined by data. Some of us, and I grew up with that expectation that knowledge drives you to change the way you act. But you'll see it's not quite that simple. Now, the downside, you know, the dire stuff is pretty ridiculous. You look, if you've seen the updated curves, the great acceleration curves, this is us, you know, the curve of us is all like zoom. Virtually every curve of us, the resources that we're taking, the emissions that we're producing, our numbers on the planet, just our numbers of people, consumptive appetites, have had this look for about 200 years. We kind of dribbled along as a species for thousands, tens of thousands of years, and then this happened. There's still many ideas about how much was agriculture, how much was fossil fuels. The bottom line is we're exerting this enormous pulse of activity on the planet. And when you look close up, this is what that looks like. Can you all see it okay? This was a photographer, a friend of mine at the Times. Every year we write about Black Friday down. Do they have Black Friday in Canada? You know, it's like the shop holiday. So now, of course, in the States, it's now moved to Thursday. Actually, Black Friday starts on Thanksgiving itself on the Thursday of that week. But this is what it looks like. So can you imagine, you know, here we are heading toward 9 billion people. Can you imagine 2050 or so, 2060, 9 billion people shopping at Target or wherever you're? What is that? That doesn't feel good. That doesn't feel good. Right? It feels like a lot of trouble. And then down on the ground, in places like sub-Saharan Africa, you have all kinds of outcomes from this consumptive push. The ivory trade, of course, is devastating elephant populations, killing a lot of park rangers at the same time, facilitating. You have this intersection of drug trade and disruptive guerrilla movements and ivory, and it's a horrific thing. And you think, but of course, we here in North America, we had our kind of our ecocide as well. This is a stack of bison skulls. This was somewhere in the east, but what happened was we slaughtered so many bison in the Great Plains that the plains were littered with these skulls. And it turns out that in late 1800s, it was if you make charcoal out of bone like that, you end up with a pigment called carbon black. So those skulls were all shipped east to be turned into pigment for us to draw with and stuff like that. And so, you know, it's not like what's happening right now in Africa is a new phenomenon. We almost extinguished deer. Where I live in the Hudson Valley, it's hard to believe that just the white-tailed deer was almost extinguished, and now it's overabundant. So that gets a lot of people, including me a few years ago, thinking that there's, you know, you look around and you say there's not much to distinguish us from bacteria on a plate of agar. You know, you smear bacteria on agar, and it just kind of grows until you end up with the feedbacks from the wastes and stuff, and then it stops. But so you would think, and I've written about this in many different contexts, you would think that somehow we could be smarter than that. And even I've talked about that in the context of dinosaurs, when you think about impacts and extinctions. You know, I have some friends, two former astronauts, who have been pushing hard for us to develop the capacity to deter an asteroid, should we find one that's on a path toward Earth. And I wrote a piece a few years back, can we be smarter than dinosaurs? But so far, it's like mostly like this. You look around and you think, geez, we're not really getting it. And science, the science that I've written about now for decades, has basically been saying, hey, everybody, there's an edge to your Petri dish. You know, that's what science has been saying. Whether you call it planetary boundaries, whatever your terminology is, that's the message. And the scientists doing this have looked like this. This is Martin Parry in 2007 at the IPCC rollout and the AR4, the fourth IPCC report. And it's kind of, you know what this reminds me of? It's kind of like Moses coming down from the mount, you know, with the tablets, with the lightning, and going, you know, thou shalt not. And there's and even the planetary boundaries work uses the word transgress. Thou shalt not transgress these boundaries. And what's society's reaction been so far? It reminds me of a teenager. One of my teenage son is back in the hotel, and for the last 2 days I've been gently prodding him to get serious about doing his homework, you know, and even though he's here with us on vacation, he's got some work to do, but guess what, he kind of resists that. So, and we have been very resistant to this kind of message, and it reminds me of this. Rebel without a cause. That's kind of, you know, H. Sapiens so far is kind of like a rebel without a cause. And we're just like, wow, look what we can do. And I've written a bunch of pieces since 2008 with that sort of puberty on a scale of a planet kind of approach. Is that what's going on? Are we just not mature yet as a species? We're kind of young, and the scientists are like the grown-up in the room, and that resistance seems to echo what I see here. And that leads me, and it's led a lot of people in this arena, to feel like this photographer, TV cameraman at the Copenhagen climate talks. I took this picture the last day of the Copenhagen meeting in the press room. There was like 2,000 of us in there. We'd been in there for 2 weeks writing about a meeting that was ultimately inconsequential, and we were all sapped by that. And a lot of people I know who've either been scientists or communicators or scholars in this arena have all felt that sense of dissipation. Now, despite all that, personally, and I have to stress personally, I can't prove any of this, I think there's room for optimism that we can squeeze, at least sneak through this century and come out the other end with a reasonably productive planet and communities and ecosystems. They won't be what I grew up with. Nothing will be like I grew up with, and like the younger people in this room. There's a lot of change in the works. But it reminds me of Thornton Wilder wrote this great play. His lesser known play, Our Town, was the most famous one, The Skin of Our Teeth, which is about the Antrobus family, meaning about us. And it's, the play has this sort of spiraling structure to the plot, and with lots of hammers, lots of bangs and setbacks along the way, which kind of is like the human history. And I think there is a path forward that can at least get us through by the skin of our teeth, and I'll explain why, and we can discuss this at the end. But to explain what brings me to that conclusion after 30-plus years writing about this stuff, I do have to go back in time, not quite to 1956. This is, if you go to populationaction.org, and if you have a device, you have permission to use it. This is not like a class. You go there, and you type in your birth date, and you can find where you are in the curve of us. So this was me, March 25th, 1956. You know, there are 2.79 billion of us at that time. And now it's, what, 7.2 or so? But it's an interesting exercise to do that, and you can tweet about it when you do it. It's been, you know, we're in the midst of a remarkable ride. I mean, look at that. Again, that same curve. And now, you can look at that and go, oh, my God, or you can look at that and go, wow, what an incredible time to be a young scholar focused on environmental questions and solutions, because if there ever was a time to engage, it's now, because that curve is going to change, hopefully in my lifetime, certainly in the lifetimes of many people in this room. That curve is going to change fundamentally. By 2050 or 2060, it will have a very different shape. And it could be a jaggedish line, or it could be maybe a smoother one if we get busy and find ways to modulate trajectories. And that's, again, what I'll be talking about. So for me, though, I got to get back to this idea that I grew up with the old norms. I grew up with the environmental movement. I felt immersed in it, and I was part of it. 1968, I'm in Rhode Island. I was around 12 years old that year. This is me and my brother. I like to fish, and that was one of my first connections to the environment, was through fishing. The local stream, the stream was right behind a supermarket, you know, it was suburbia, and there was old shopping carts down there and stuff like that. But it was a green place. It was a place for me to have a refuge. It was a place for me to build my relationship with the world. And it felt wonderful. Although 1968, for those of us who are old enough to remember, was hardly a halcyon period. It was Vietnam War. It was two epic assassinations, Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King down in the States. The nuclear peril was still there, duck and cover. The big bestseller that year was The Population Bomb. That Paul Ehrlich's book sold 2 million copies, and he was on The Tonight Show and all that stuff, and it was, you know, there was a lot of this. Woe is me. This is like one of the most resonant messages of the environmental and social movements of that time, where, you know, we were really in bad shape. And another one was shame on you. It was someone's fault. Pick your president or your company, especially in the environmental realm, it was someone's fault. And that actually crested through the late 20th century and persists today. Woe is me and shame on you are kind of the dominant memes of this movement. And I think we have to move forward beyond them. They're still valuable, as I'll show you, but I think we have to do something more. My first shame on you moment came right around 1968. So I told you about that stream I used to walk through the woods from my house to. And then one day I was walking through the woods toward that stream behind the supermarket, and there was this bulldozer parked there. I wasn't like present enough to take the picture at the time. It's not like now where everyone has a smartphone. This is a picture I found on the web. It's illustrating the moment in my life. This is not, you know, if it was now, I would have tweeted it. You know, WTF, there's a bulldozer in the woods. What's this about? It wasn't like that back then. At any rate, I was irate. You know, these were my woods. It wasn't my property, but it felt like my woods. And so I ran back to the house, and I got a piece of paper and a pen, and I wrote a death threat. Actually, this was my monkey wrench kind of period. I was only 12, so and hopefully I'm forgiven since then. I put it on the seat of the bulldozer, and it said something like, you know, whosoever ruins these woods shall die a horrible death, or something like that. So that was kind of my first environmental action. Now, of course, again, I wasn't present enough in another way. I wasn't present enough, conscious enough, to recognize that there had been a bulldozer that had created the suburban development I was living in just a few years earlier. It was a, you know, newish house, suburban Rhode Island. And if I had really thought this through, I would have realized, well, is it the bulldozer that's the problem or something else? But that was kind of, again, what I grew up with. And I, so what was me and shame on you? It drove me. I got a biology degree as an undergraduate. And I ended up going overseas. I was lucky enough to get a fellowship when I graduated to head over to the Pacific. And I spent some time out there researching man's relationship to the sea. It was this ridiculously lucky thing. And this is me in 1979 in Bali, in Indonesia. And then I stumbled onto a sailboat. Now, this is relevant because this is the trip that made me want to be a journalist. And so I had that environmental consciousness from earlier. I got overseas. I got onto a sailboat. That's me. We were getting ready to head to Indonesia from Australia at that time. I didn't own the boat. Actually, no one on the boat owned the boat. We were delivering it for this guy. And I saw the big world, you know. We saw the middle of the Indian Ocean. I went from New Zealand on this trip to Europe, a year and a half. By the way, for the young people in the room, the moral of this story is, if you have a chance to go anywhere weird, do it now. And do it when you're unencumbered and get out and around, because that's the best moment in your life to have that kind of experience. For me, this trip made me want to be a journalist, not just because I was, you know, this was in the Maldives. We were leaving one of the islands there, just extraordinary. But we got to Djibouti, the base of the Red Sea. Anyone been to Djibouti or that area of Africa? It's devastating. Poverty and scant resources. And we were restocking the boat and stuff, and I was walking around the streets of Djibouti, and I saw this weird scene. At first, I thought it was rugs or something. And as I got closer, I realized these are leopard skins. So I took this picture, and I was like, it was things like this that made me shift from being track toward being a marine biologist to writing about stuff I was seeing, to being a journalist. And taking pictures too. It was just, you look at that, I looked at that and I said, you know, I hadn't focused on this whole sustainability concept yet, but at that point, that felt to me, utterly unsustainable. Whatever was happening there was not sustainable. So I became a journalist. I got back to the real world and left the boat and started reporting about the environment, mostly about science and the environment. And it's been a long journey since then. I've been to the Amazon. I wrote this book about Chico Mendes, the murdered rubber tapper in 1989. That was me up on the Juruá River. I've been to the Arctic. I've been up the Hudson River. This is an Atlantic sturgeon being tagged. It's incredible. It's been an incredible experience to have had to be a note taker, a picture taker, a describer of science in so many different kinds of landscapes and situations. But again, I've also seen really troubling things. When I was in the Amazon in 1989, I interviewed this girl's mother. She had had, I have to read through the book, it was either 15 or 17 kids, and only less than 10 of them were alive at that point. And it was normal in that part of the Amazon to have that level of mortality for children. And I took this picture in Manaus, which was already a big city. I was just wandering down a street one day in Manaus, and there was this a funeral parlor, and it was a kind of open air front, and I saw the stack of coffins. It was kind of like coffee cups in Starbucks, you know, small, medium, large, and boy, that got to me. And so a lot of my reporting since then has been focused on the social issues, which are interlaced with environmental problems. You know, what's causing that mortality is disease for the most part, and it was just really, it sticks with you when you see that kind of thing. And I'm sure some of you have seen that kind of thing. So back to the journalism. My first big story, magazine story, was about paraquat, a weed killer, an herbicide, that was getting really popular. And it's actually an incredibly valuable agricultural tool. If you know about no-till agriculture, I'm sure the campus over here, the one out of town, I'm sure they do a lot of research on no-till agriculture, where you don't plow the soil. You can plant right into the weed base and have productive agriculture without the runoff and the erosion. But it turned out it's very toxic stuff. A paraquat, if you drank it accidentally particularly, it kills you in a very horrific way. So at that time, I did a long investigative piece on that aspect of this technology. And it was actually really easy. You know, you think about investigative reporting as being digging through documents and finding the goods, getting the goods on someone. But here, this was a picture. I don't know if you can see it. If you can't see it, I can dim the lights a little bit. There was a brochure for one of these, the herbicide company, that had this picture of a guy in a field in Asia somewhere with bare legs spraying the herbicide on his field. That was in their actual brochure. So, like, this didn't require a lot of digging. And this is the shame on you part. I mean, there is plenty of shame on you activity out there that deserves to be exposed, and that hopefully, in the hopes that that will change the way things work. And it did, you know, in the end, that industry has changed a lot. But that, it was kind of easy. The shame on you stuff is vital, but it's not sufficient to me. So then along comes nuclear winter, which someone is looking at right now. 1985. Now, what happened with nuclear winter, it's really interesting. The story, nuclear winter was this very stark, scary idea when it first emerged in 1983 or so. And then Steve Schneider and Starley Thompson, two climate scientists at NCAR in Boulder, Colorado, did some more modeling and more analysis, and they did a paper where they called it, it's looking more like nuclear autumn. Just think about that. If you're a newspaper editor and your reporter comes up to you and says, well, look, new paper, it's about nuclear autumn. Is that going to make the front page? No. But and that told me a lot about, you know, thinking when a new idea emerges, usually what happens is science then dives in deeper. And more science doesn't always make things clearer. It can actually make things much more nuanced. In fact, that's historically, if you look at a lot of environmental problems, it's been more of that than the other way around, where it gets starker and worse. So in this case, it got like, okay, you know, maybe, and then of course the Cold War kind of dragged to an end, and if as long as Ukraine doesn't blow up, we probably won't have to worry about nuclear winter very much. Although Alan Robach at Rutgers is still worried about even an India-Pakistan nuclear exchange cooling things off in a bad way. So, wrong way. 1988 was my first big long article on global warming. And that was the year Yellowstone National Park in the States was on fire. Big drought, and actually Europe and North America had record heat. And Jim Hansen was testifying in Senate about, to him, the science was already clear that we were discernibly changing the climate system. So it made for, I kind of like the cover art, you know. We all want to get attention for things, and so you can end up with some stark oversimplification sometimes in journalism, as you know. But this story, unlike this one, was not transitory. It didn't flash out and go away. And it wasn't just because the Cold War, it wasn't like the Cold War. You know, the emissions rates for all these gases have just amplified tremendously since then, since 1988. My first book on global warming, I wrote in 1992. These are all online, by the way. I posted the whole global warming article several years back, and the text of my book is online, too. So if you want to find it, just Google for Revkin, 1988, warming, whatever, or 1992. And this book led me in a lot of interesting directions. When I was writing it, I was thinking a lot about, again, this era that we... The growth curves, you know, that whole spurting great acceleration thing. And so I wrote this, there's a section in the book where I was reflecting on where we're at as a species, and I wrote, perhaps Earth scientists of the future will name this new post-Holocene era for its causative element for us. We're entering an age that might someday be referred to as, say, the Anthropocene. I'll get to that in a second. After all, it's a geological age of our own making. The challenge now is to find a way to act that will make geologists of the future look upon this age as a remarkable time, a time in which a species began to take into account the long-term impact of its actions. So again, this has been like the theme. This has basically been the question I've been reporting ever since. It's like, can we grow up? Can we absorb what we're seeing in a way that we can meaningfully change these trajectories? How much of that is a technological challenge? How much of it is a consumptive habit, behavioral challenge? How much of it is a legislative, legal, top-down kind of prospect? How much of it is a bottom-up process? And those are the questions we're all dealing with in a big way right now, is this idea of the Anthropocene, or as the Brits call it, or Anthropocene, as most Americans seem to call it, which has emerged since Crutzen and Stormer wrote in a more formal way the same kind of thing. And this gets it to the importance. I didn't really know Greek roots of words, and back then I was just thinking of what kind of word would like make sense and be sort of efficient off the tongue, Anthracene. So I just wrote it. There were two different scientists who peer-reviewed the book, and they missed it. If they had said, well, it should be Anthropocene. I am a footnote in Wikipedia for the Anthropocene reference. And that's fine. But it's all cool, you know, but the idea is there. And it's an important one. So then I kind of migrated into this form of journalism. Magazines are the ultimate kind of language. You kind of do a bunch of reporting. You go to places. You take notes. You come back. You have time to think. And then I got into the newspaper world in the mid-90s onward. And it was all kind of rush, and you're competing for the front page with stories about the New York Yankees or about the stock market or about Iraq or about ISIS. Well, I left the Times before ISIS became a phenomenon. But it was a very different kind of a dynamic, and I got used to it, and I got familiar with all the weaknesses and problems that happened because of those pressures. We can talk about that more in Q&A. And I was still doing plenty of Shame on You stuff. When Jim Hansen called me and said some Bush appointees, political appointees, were pressuring people at NASA to not talk about climate science, I wrote a bunch of stories, not just about his issue, but it turned out when Bush, the re-election, 2004, when President Bush was trying to get re-elected, that's when they clamped down. There was this pattern. It was actually almost statistically significant. The press releases from NASA on climate science done by NASA just plunged. There was kind of a regular drumbeat of press releases, and then it went away because it was, you know, President Bush's team didn't want anything discussed about global warming. And it became a pretty big story. And so that, you know, again, as a journalist, that's a really what we call a get. A get is like, whoa, that was a really good get, Andy. That's like when you really nail something. Two different people in the White House had to leave their jobs because of this. So that's cool. But is it sufficient? You know, I kept saying to myself, you know, I'm starting to get to be almost a gray beard at this time. You've been at this a while, you know, and should I go through the rest of my career just like getting people fired? Is that a way to solve the climate problem? And I became more and more convinced that that wasn't the case. And this is partially because of another line of reporting I began doing, which is in the behavioral sciences. And this was the scariest stuff of all. You know, I've been on this cracking, shifting, floating sea ice at the North Pole, you know, where there's literally cracks forming under your feet, and scientists are saying, no, don't worry, you just jump over the cracks. I've been to the Amazon, where I interviewed the murderers of Chico Mendez, one in prison, the other sitting on his front porch. You know, these really psychotic ranchers. I've been in scary situations, but when I dove in on this research about what makes smart people think differently and feel differently about things like global warming, it was like, oh my God, we're not going to get this remotely right if we think this is just an information problem. Now think about this. I mean, we're talking existential threat to a reporter. Because what is my job? I'm a science writer. So, you know, I'm just like trying to communicate science better. And then I look at all the science saying, peer-reviewed science that says, you know, information doesn't matter. I was like, and so if you want to just dive in a little bit at culturalcognition.net, that's the website of Dan Kahane at Yale, who's really done a bunch of, quantified work showing how this can happen. And what I've illustrated here is how you can have four Nobel Prize winning physicists, so they know physics, they won Nobel Prizes, who have very divergent views of this thing we call global warming, ranging from Bert Richter, who is he was at SLAC, Stanford's accelerator. He's a big proponent of nuclear power and other options as a way to cut our emissions of global warming gases. Very smart guy. Steve Chu, of course, was, you know, carbon tax and innovation. Ivar Gaever at Rensselaer, when he saw the American Physical Society come out with a few years back with their statement on climate change, he went ballistic because it had the word incontrovertible in it. And he said, that's religion, that's not science. You can't say anything in science is incontrovertible. Robert Laughlin, he's kind of in the mushy middle. So anyway, and here, I mean, there's work here. and elsewhere that shows you the most scientifically literate people in the climate debate are at the edges. The people who are most convinced it's a hoax and the people who are most convinced it's a really important problem are equally literate about, like, what's a greenhouse gas and that stuff. So anyway, that for me was a real big problem. And what I've been trying to do is work with that information. What the same studies show you lots of things that give you ways forward, but they don't say that more information on global warming is the way to go to make progress. So we can talk about that too. And then there's this other thing, which is just, you know, we know about the shame on you kind of the Exxons of the world who clearly would like to keep burning Peabody Energy, you know, the coal giant. You know, we like fossil fuels, and they would like us to keep burning them. They can say what they want about global warming being a serious problem. But there's this other factor. You know, you don't. It's hard to have you can't sort of point to inertia as a villain. Inertia is, this is society. This is us on fossil fuels. I mean, we're sitting here in a room heated mostly by fossil fuels. A lot of hydro here, right, Quebec? So that's cool. But like, so if you want to change the world, if you want to decarbonize the global energy system, and you're saying, hey, let's do something about climate change, and then if you want to say no, the guy with the feather duster is just like, all you have to do, that's such an easy task. Maintaining the status quo is a very easy task. And that's why I've also written some pieces periodically saying that even if we had perfect climate information, even if there was no fog of disinformation or misinformation or don't expect magical change because of this as much as because of many other things. And that's kind of depressing. But don't worry, I'm not going to be depressing the whole time. So, and then Jesse Ossebel at Rockefeller University, he spoke these lines a while back. Politicians are mostly pulling on disconnected levers, meaning, like, when you look at the treaty process, or even when we were having that discussion for a climate bill in the United States, when you dig in on that bill, even if it had passed, it had so much wiggle room in it that the question of whether it was going to actually drive any change is a really significant question. And so Jesse really focused my attention on that reality that mostly our politics is reflecting what's possible, not determining what's possible. Even the Montreal Protocol, here we are in Montreal, was largely doable because the alternatives to CFCs were already developed, and they were affordable. It wasn't like an economy-stopping question to move away from CFCs. So I'm going to speed up here because I really want to focus on the upside. This is .earth came about, and really out of this reality, this realization in the mid to late 2007 or so, I was getting less and less eager to write big articles about global warming because of what I just was telling you about. But also because when you write a story for the front page of a newspaper, even though it might feel big, it's actually really compressed and it's oversimplified. And I saw so many instances where I had to make compromises with reality, you know, where I didn't feel like I was actually being true to the nature of the problem. And with a blog, which I was doing even when I was a news reporter, I started this on my own, just like that Guggenheim Fellowship that I got ostensibly to write a book, the research for that book became .earth. And it basically, it's a journey. To me, it's a much more honest approach to complex, wicked questions because I'm looking at it, you're basically looking over my shoulder at me learning. I'm not Walter Cronkite back in the States in the day, you know, telling you that's the way it is at the end of each night's broadcast. Because with an issue like climate change, with all those facets about developing country need for energy, with on and on, the complexities and the science, the idea that you could just have a that's the way it is approach to conveying that kind of story, I think, is not useful. It's not useless, but this feels truer to the issue. So I kind of built this blog around this question, which is, as I've said here, this was a whiteboard. My friend Jeremy and I, Jeremy Zalar, who just left the paper in a buyout. The paper's shrinking the staff. But we sat in a room for weeks with a whiteboard trying to say, well, what is .earth going to be about? And I kept kind of like just riffing on things. And in the end, it's about a question. It's about this idea of a race. We're in a race between our environmental potency, and our self-awareness, as I said, our awareness of environmental change, but also our awareness of those issues I was telling you about up here. And that's, so it's like a three-legged race, and it's complicated. And so the blog is a journey, and readers follow along if they're interested in my, if they feel I can be a reliable guide to these questions. And it's been interesting. And I'm always, it's always interesting for me. I wrote a piece a couple of years ago calling myself a selfish blogger because I actually, it would be hard for me to stop. It's a lot of work, but it's how I interrogate the world. And to me, it's a really valuable purpose. It's a really valuable thing that I'm, for myself. So now, in all this, I've kind of like laid out the downside of the old model, whether it's the journalistic model or the old model of environmentalism, which was about finger-pointing and the idea that everything had to be a law. If you pass a law, that will change the world. And it worked. It worked for the clean, you know, the clean water. Well, depends on who you talk to. My friend John Cronin at Pace University feels the Clean Water Act we had in the States was an utter failure, that we never met the targets and all that stuff. But I think overall our waters are far cleaner than they would have been without that legislation. Endangered Species Act is a very powerful tool, maybe even a little too powerful. But it's those things are worked. But now on the global scale, especially with something like global warming, where the molecule of CO2 from a Beijing power plant or from a Boston taxi cab doesn't matter. The atmosphere doesn't care. You know, how do you regulate, legislate that when every country comes to these negotiations with a fundamentally different set of factors? You know, India is 1.9 tons per person per year carbon footprint. We have 17 in the States now. And that we're down from 20. Canada's a little more, I think, than the U.S. At any rate, you know, so like how do you work that out in a treaty? Forget about it. So those are all about goals. You know, all of our rhetoric around the environment, and it can be useful, has been framed around goals. The goals are things like numbers, like 350, or 80% by 2050, you know, cutting emissions, or 2 degrees, thou shalt not transgress, two degrees, on and on. You have, it's important, obviously, to have some sense of where you're going, but when you have these goals, and I'm sure many of you know that when you look at today's trajectories and you look at those goals, you've seen, there's plenty of papers on this, we don't know how to get there. I mean, you could say on a piece of paper how to get there, but how do you do that in the real world? How do you make it actionable? I don't think we know. So it started me shifting to traits. Well, if you don't know how to reach a goal, but you know the general direction you want to go into, then I started asking myself, well, what are the traits that you would want in a society or in individuals that give you the best chance of torquing those trajectories toward the place you want to go? And I started listing them. I kind of started realizing, you know, there are things you can work on here. And I tweeted about this in, when was this? 2013. I just did a series of 8 tweets. I'll tell more. I like Twitter. I'll tell you about it in a minute. So, strategy for sustainable human progress: bend, stretch, reach, teach, reveal, reflect, rejoice, repeat. I'll elaborate. And then I did 8 tweets, one for each of those words. And then I wrote a piece on the blog that was like elaborating more on those words. And you know, you can come up with your own lexicon. These words are just my own markers for things that are actionable, even facing a complex problem. And everyone in the room, I encourage you, it doesn't have to be, I'm also a songwriter, as you know, so there's a little rhyme here, you know. I haven't done a song around this yet, but for me, these work. And here's what I mean. So bend has multiple meanings. The most familiar one is resilience, which is totally overused word. And, I mean, we all know this is one of many designs for a New York City that will be much more able to absorb hits from hurricanes in the future, whether... I mean, we still don't know really very well what hurricanes are going to do in the Northeast in a warming climate, with warming seas. But we do know that New York is utterly vulnerable to hurricanes. And it was hit in 1821 by one that it came at low tide, thankfully. If it had come at high tide, it would have made Sandy look like a walk in the park. So, but we know how to do that. You can have this sort of magically wonderful soft landscapes. You could have sort of walkways between buildings instead of hard surfaces. Obviously, you can protect the subway entrances. all this many things you can do, but how do you actually do that in the real world? That's the question. Because think about this: Mayor Bloomberg, just before he left office, he gave this classic politician speech about the future of New York in a global warming world, and he said, "We will not retreat." Those are almost a direct quote from that speech. So you think about the "we will not retreat" a political reality, because who's going to get elected saying "we will retreat"? Can you imagine a speech? Can you imagine Stephen Harper or anyone saying, having a speech? Well, think of any politician and imagine that speech. We will retreat. How do you do that? You can't do that. So coming up, the innovation, the bend isn't just like coming up with a clever design for a softer city. It's like, how do you actually make that happen? Bend is also, though, adaptability in people. Billy Parrish, here in the bare feet, back, this is him in 2005. I met him at the Montreal climate talks when they were here in 2005. I just realized that another time I was here. And he was an energy activist in the hallways doing the sit-ins and stuff, and really good at it. And now, but he's kind of like a salmon swimming upstream. That didn't work for him in the end. He felt frustrated that it was insufficient. And so he's shifted into being more of an entrepreneur. And this isn't just like, you know, guys in suits are cooler, you're growing up, become a financial blah, blah. He's adaptable. He found another way to work on the same problem. This Join Mosaic is this company he's come up with that helps to finance solar installations on nonprofit, like in Oakland, California, on the roof of a nonprofit group. How do you come up with the cash to have that happen? Well, they've created a fund where anyone, even small investors, even a couple hundred bucks, can put in money. You end up getting a good return on the money, and it gives the financial place to go to install the solar panels. And so what I love about his path is this sense of adaptability, agility. He keeps his eye on the prize, but he's willing to sort of divert and find the path that might work best. And then in the science community, and in young people, we have to get comfortable, I think, in the environmental movement with more variety. The variety is your friend. Not every scientist is going to be like Jim Hansen, handcuffing himself to coal company facilities. Susan Solomon, who ran the IPCC report rollout in 2007, she had an utterly different view of the role of science in these policy questions. She was badgered at that meeting in Paris, I talked to you about it a few minutes ago, by a BBC reporter, "Tell us how you feel about this." You know, she had given the press conference on the science, and she just was like, "No, that's not my job. Here's the science. My job is to lay it out. Your job, society, is to feel about it and do something about it." And then on the other front, you've got technological innovators, and you have hallway agitators, you have divestment movement, and you have people who would rather spend their time in a lab coming up with a better photovoltaic chemistry. And that's fine. It's all part of what I think is needed, is this sort of variety is the spice of life, and getting comfortable with that. And it can lead to some pretty hard, it's hard to grapple with that sometimes, because even my own household, my wife is anti-nuclear. I'm kind of anti-existing nuclear, but I'm really a big advocate of increasing our research on the next generation of nuclear power plants. And that, I think there's room for all of that. As there's all kinds of debates that divide us when maybe they shouldn't. I haven't written about this on Dot Earth yet, but I keep thinking about this paper. I'm sure some of you know this paper from 2003. I stumbled on this when I was just Googling for response diversity, meaning environmental problem response diversity. And I didn't realize that in the ecological community, there was this really interesting work. What this is saying is that biodiversity, meaning the number of species in an ecosystem, isn't the thing to think about so much. Think about the response of the critters in an ecosystem to environmental stress. The response, diverse responses, that leads to resilience. And I just find that fascinating. And so I kind of played around with this, because to me it echoed society. So if you just change some of these terms, like the diversity of responses to environmental change among people contributing to the same social function, which we call response diversity, is critical to resilience. Response diversity is particularly important for ecosystem and social renewal and reorganization following change. In other words, you know, having multiple responses to the same stress I think is our friend. Now, I've been talking to a bunch of social scientists about this question, and I'll be writing something about it eventually. But I just think that this articulates for me what seems to be, it's a hypothesis. I'm not sure if it's testable, but it's something to think about. And here's one way to think about it. So George Monbiot in England, he's kind of like the Bill McKibben of England, you know, climate. And Bill McKibben is the Bill McKibben of North America, the United States. And after Fukushima happened, they each one on the same day, they had columns in The Guardian. And George somehow looked at this mess and said, this proves that we need nuclear power more than ever. And what his take on this was a really crappy nuclear power plant complex, and it still didn't totally melt down and create an environmental catastrophe. I mean, obviously, it's created economic and social huge disruption, but it hasn't been a Chernobyl kind of event in that sense. And Bill McKibben wrote this piece saying, this proved that nuclear power is too brittle, that we got to go small, you know, the usual Bill McKibben thing. Now, and I think somewhere in between these guys is reality, and that's this response diversity thing in the social context that I'm talking about. So that was a big bend. That was a bend is a big word. These are quicker. Stretch is, like, to me, innovation, reaching toward new ideas, testing them. This was a guy I wrote about, Ben Gulak. He was, actually, I think he's Canadian, come to think of it. He was a freshman at MIT a number of years ago, and he started working on, he'd been to China on a family summer trip and saw the traffic, and he said, I'm going to invent an electric motorcycle. And he started working on an electric motorcycle, and you notice there's something weird about it. It has two wheels, but they're side by side, and it has a gyroscopic kind of stabilization thing. I don't know. And the company still exists. It's a startup. I don't think we're all going to be riding around in these anytime soon. And I don't think 9 billion people riding on electric motorcycles is going to save the climate system. But what I like about him is he saw a problem. He came back. He used the skill set that he had, which was mechanical engineering, and started to focus on how to solve it. The problem is, the but here is that we're just asleep at the wheel in terms of, this is U.S., but I imagine it's similar in Canada. And it's similar, I know, in the OECD countries. This is a history of where we put our basic science funding. It starts with Sputnik. Remember, the Russians kind of scared the poop out of us early 1950s. And the yellow here is the space race. All you need to know here is that that is about $30 billion a year in constant dollars. So $30 billion a year in constant dollars seems to be reflect when we really care about something. So we really cared about going to the moon, and we got to the moon, and then we sort of built the space shuttle, and then we stopped caring about space, and so that kind of went away. It's built up a little bit more. War on cancer is the purple. So, you know, we really care about cancer. It hasn't really accomplished a lot, but it tells you it's a proxy for what we care about. So that's about $40 billion a year in constant dollars. So can anyone, actually in the back of the room, you probably can't even see it. Energy is here. Basic energy research, blah, 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 blah. And it's like an anaconda that swallowed a rabbit or something. And that was the oil crisis in the 70s. So there was one moment when we actually started to care about energy innovation, energy science. And then it dribbled away. And there's no Republican, Democrat. Do you see any kind of pattern here with presidents and Congresses coming and going? It kind of just goes and goes. And then here, remember Obama, he spent all these billions during the stimulus. This was to get out of the recession. Let's do a big stimulus thing on green jobs and energy. That's it. That was the stimulus package. And now what's happened since then? Of course, dribble, dribble, dribble. And now with oil prices down because of the innovation in shale extraction, I don't count on that. There's no indication here that energy science is something we really care about. It's a problem. I write about it almost like the catechism thing. You know, I'm not Catholic, but I write about it as regularly as someone would preach about something. Now, here's the really disturbing thing. Whoops. Let me just go back one more. This entire curve of general science investment is the red here. So this is defense science, the gray. This is a, you know, 70 billion a year. That's not buying tanks, that's science. It's basic science with an orientation toward making better weapons and all that stuff. And look at all of that science. all of that non-defense science is the red. So that's, again, this is what we, you know, quote unquote, care about. It's kind of an issue for me. And I don't think, we could do a whole other hour on that. So we're not really there on the stretch. We're not facilitating the stretch. Reach is mostly about communication and the empathy that comes with communication. In India, there's some wonderful innovation recently where, can you imagine if you're in charge of the Agricultural Extension Service in India, 120 million farming families spread out over a huge subcontinent, how do you reach all those people, even with cell phones and all that stuff? So they started using YouTube as a way to work with farmers who've adopted useful practices, changing a planting rotation, and the farmers explain through little videos that they make locally the innovation and why it makes sense to them. So you have farmer-to-farmer sharing of information through this YouTube channel. And, of course, not every farmer has a computer, but every village has an internet cafe now or some way to get that information around. So finding ways to amplify the stuff we're already doing, whether it's agricultural extension or so many other things, there's never been more ways to do that. This thing, the hashtag, #, how many of you are on Twitter? Be proud, come on, I can't see. Not a lot, maybe a third? What would you say that was? Not more than a third. Most of us, when I teach about social media, most young people are not interested in Twitter. But I think it's a great thing. It's a great place to go. You have to harness it, you have to tame it. Don't let it take over your life. And the hashtag is a really profound innovation. It's not as big a deal as the LED light bulb, but it's really significant. And it was invented. It was invented by a guy named Chris Messina. It was August 23rd, 2007. He was working at Mozilla, the company that made Firefox. And he just one day on Twitter just said, hey, how do you feel about using #? For groups? As in # Barcamp. And what # Barcamp is some programmer's term. And they started to have a conversation in the Twitter space among programmers that could be in the Silicon Valley or in San Diego where he was or in China. But they could have a conversation around that term and amid all that morass of noise. And it's a great organizing tool. I'll show you a couple examples. So there's tons of noise. Most of Twitter is Kardashian, Bieber, whatever. And it's like, I still don't know. I was just looking last night. Who are the Kardashians anyway? I was on Wikipedia. How did that come to be? Who are these? It's insane. Anyway, so it's mostly like that. But then these hashtags are organizing principles within all that stuff. EdTech is one for people working on the role of technology in the classroom. EnviroEd is what we're all doing here, environmental education. AgChat is a weekly discussion about agricultural innovation. WJChat is web journalism, online journalism. People who, every Wednesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, there's a live conversation around that tag where people just talk about questions about a new infographic or a new way to create a blog. Bird Class is my favorite. University of Connecticut professor Margaret Rubega, around 2008 or so, she started assigning her students. They had to get on Twitter. Most of them weren't. And they had a standing assignment every week when they weren't in the classroom. If they saw birds, she's a biology teacher, if they saw birds doing something quirky, they were supposed to tweet about it. Tweeting about bird behavior is kind of cute. So for her, pedagogically, she could track their assignment pretty well because you just go on Twitter and you put in that hashtag and you can see the whole flow of that, who's actually out there looking at birds or not. She found that students were much more engaged with bird behavior than they were when they had to write it down, because they're all like doing this anyway. And then more recently, people on the outside have seen this hashtag floating around in Twitter. And now, so I saw recently someone in Arizona or somewhere one day tweeted a photo of a hawk or something asking, did anyone know what this was? And they used that hashtag as a way to get expertise, an answer from someone, from a group that they knew was pretty knowledgeable about birds. So Pace Blog is for my blogging course. All my courses at Pace have hashtags attached to them. Let me just give you another. So Facebook, oh my God. Facebook. Facebook is pretty, it's hard to say what's useful about it. But then a few years ago, an art student in Halifax named Isaac Freshia created something that on its surface looks like a Facebook conversation. But when you look at this closer, I'll just read a couple of entries for you in the back of the room. You realize it's not. It's Tiger posts, totally screwed, like 3,200 of me left, sad face. And then Panda likes this. And then Panda says, I don't mean like good. I mean like I feel you, bro. I'm around 2,500 now. Marine Turtle says, oh no, really? I'm sorry to hear that, sad face. Chin up, though. Rhino, doubtful. You know, and he created, this is a piece of art he created with a Photoshop or something. And then he put it on Facebook, and it went flying all around the world, tens of thousands of forwards and viral this, that, and the other. And it was all connected to a World Wildlife Fund initiative related to endangered species. And I think that illustrates that here's a kid in Halifax, you know, who's actually become a part of the global conversation about endangered species just by being clever, by creating a piece of artwork that can get into that conversation that's mostly about cute animals, you know, doing tricks and babies and stuff. Teach, of course, so Ben Stretch reached Teach. Teach is a no-brainer, but it's not like teaching facts. That's very 20th century. It's about teaching how to learn, teaching complexity, and teaching systems. I know someone here is into teaching systems. A couple of years ago, I gave a speech where I said, you know, the one thing I think would be great for every school in America is to have a field trip, an annual field trip to the boiler room in the school, not to like the museum or whatever. You don't need permission slips. You don't need a budget for buses. And when I after I gave that talk, someone noticed it on Dot Earth or somewhere, and a woman who in New York City said, "No, we're doing that." She said, "Solar One is the name of her group, and they do curricula for science and environment curricula." And she said there's a school in the Bronx, it's the Bronx High School of, it's a public high school, the Bronx High School of Energy and Technology, where they do a field trip, and I went on it. I went on the field trip. So here all the students are down in the boiler room. The custodian is giving the lecture for the day about how much oil they use, and they get to look in the little porthole to see the flame in there, and they get to see they have to open vents to let enough air flow in for the combustion to be efficient. And they're learning about their school as a system. They're learning about energy. And I just thought it was so great. So that's one thing. And then complexity is like this. I mean, that's not complex. I'm sure some of you did this thing in high school or junior high, where you got the balsa wood and you had to build a bridge and a team, and then you put weight on it until it breaks. The guy in the pictures there, Mike Topchick, he used to work, that was my wife with him. She's a science teacher for a long time. And they took that and they changed it a little bit. They made it into a cost-benefit exercise. The kids had to buy their wood. And they were judged on price and performance, not just on, you know, how strong it was, which is so simplistic. So they're learning about reality, which is compromise, which is about competing factors, economy and technology. It's really sort of interesting to see. I'm running way over. Oh, yeah. Okay, so Ben Stretch, Reach Teach. Reveal is transparency, and Greenpeace does it. Sorry about the time. And Greg Asner does it in the Amazon with his overflights of the gold miners in Peru. And you can do it if you get a infrared camera and you're concerned about fracking. This is a beautiful sunny day in Colorado, oil tank, doesn't look like anything. This is the same day, but looking at that same tank with an infrared camera, you see the leaking of the vapors, the gas. This is methane and other volatiles leaking out of that tank. So just changing the wavelength of light can change your whole perception and can make your effort to convey a problem more efficient. I'm going to fast forward. Reflect, Ben Stretch, Reach, Teach, Reveal, Reflect is science. You know, again, we need to do more of it. But reflecting is also reflecting about the role of science and the limits of science in these debates. I was at the Vatican last year for four days at this meeting. It was a sustainable humanity, sustainable planet, our responsibility. This is my Zelig moment. I'm right here. Paul Crutzen is right here. Walter Monk, a legendary bunch of scientists. And we got to meet, you know, Pope Francis. And that was like, Zelig was that Woody Allen movie where he kind of pops up in these famous moments. And it was incredible because the meeting was about this intersection of data and values. It was about the is and the ought of Hume. It was about how getting understanding the limits of science, and even as I said about the limits of communication, is really vital to going forward. The last word, the second to last word is rejoice, which is just remembering what we care about. Like me as that kid, you know, the stream was behind a supermarket that I fished in, but it was a special place for me. This is my son in the Redwood area a long time ago. And then this gets to the sort of finding the good in complex places. This is in Beijing. I was there for a meeting. I went for a stroll. And in this huge city, there were people finding a green space to convene with each other, and it showed you that you can have humane urban landscapes, and I think that's a great prospect. So I'm going to just cut to the chase here. The last word is repeat. This is the hard one for me. It's discipline, like doing it all over again. Learn, you know, I could give you some examples of where if you set an environmental standard, a goal, and you reach it and you relax, in this world, that is not a success. You have to find a way to reevaluate, to keep pushing forward. And I've written about multiple examples where having the mindset that best practices is not a set of numbers. Best practices is traits. And that can get you a lot of places in a better way. And actually, I'll end with this picture. This was in Tadoussac. How many have been to Tadoussac? Yeah. So I was there a few years ago with my family. That's my son, he was like 10. And I put this up there because everything I've told you about shifting from goals to traits and how we consider paths relates to parenting as well. When I looked at my two sons when they were babies, you know, I could look at them and say, I really want him to be a doctor when he grows up, you know, earning $500,000 or whatever. Or I could say, what are the traits I want to have in my son to be sure he's adaptable, he's empathetic, he's communicative, that he has the skill sets that can give him, not a bunch of facts, but can give him a way to navigate this world successfully. That is the same thing I'm talking about when I talk about societal challenges related to sustainability. So I thank you very much. I'm sorry I went over time. Do we have time for even any questions or...
Okay. I'm getting pointed to the microphone myself. We do have time for questions, and I'll just remind people we've got the two mics and we do want to record.
Is the mic working? Try it again.
Yeah, okay. I don't like to mention this many times, but what Karl Marx said is that capitalism drains life from the nectar of life on human skulls. And this is a fact. I don't like to mention it, but to a large extent, science can be used for destructive purposes, or it can be used for liberation or to liberating the problems that people have. Now, if you're talking about environmental problems, all the enemies all around you, all these students, all these professors, they themselves are part of the exploitative system. They themselves worship the temple of divine profit. Now, how do you compromise with that? Because if these people that are at the core of the problem, these are the leaders, these are the people who basically are supposed to be the consciousness of your society. You're not going to go to the ignorant people and start telling them how to organize, or the paupers. You're going to deal with the educated people. And the educated people say, no, the divine right, the temple that we worship is the temple of profit.
Yeah, well, I think the traits that I'm talking about all apply to making sure that people understand the divisions in society that you're talking about. In other words, the more connected we are, the more aware people can become of the unempowered, the unconnected, the suffering, in a way that was not possible in the 20th century. I think there's more possibility now to have social movements cross borders, to have people understand that even as we have all the enabling properties of energy here, there are places in the world where women have to walk 4 hours a day just to get the wood to cook a little fire on in a choking cloud of smoke. You know, I think we have the capacity now to move away from, to have more empathy, more social action, through some of the things I've been talking about than ever. I had a conversation recently with a guy who was part of Cesar Chavez's movement in the 60s, and they're incorporating social media now into how they educate farm workers in the States, and again, in ways that are far more efficient than might have been possible a few decades ago. So the same tools I'm talking about here can help get at the things you're talking about, me.
Yeah, but the political environmentalism, which is very, very important, you have an army of people, students and professors, that are against all these issues.
Yeah.
So you're basically what? Just one fish in the ocean, and you're going to change the world?
I mean, one fish at a time.
And then again, you have the problems of manipulation. These same intellectuals, people who manipulate. Yes, they start saying, no, we shouldn't have nuclear power. The only reason why they say they don't want nuclear power is because they want to keep the oil prices up.
Yeah. Well, we can talk about that further. I'd love to, just because we're running out of time, I'll give you a card.
I just want to say one thing.
Yep.
This is for you. Basically, the leader of the Liberal Party, Justin Trudeau, who is himself an environmentalist, he wanted to study environment, but he couldn't do it because he was involved in politics, which will become the next prime minister. You can actually give him proposals or advice because he himself is an environmentalist.
We were just talking about that last night.
Yeah.
All right, well, again, follow up with me. I'm really easy to find. Anyway, thank you.
Undoubtedly, a lot of good work is being done both in research and in social advocacy. However, this takes place in thousands of different directions, and this diversity is then exploited by those who stop progress for their own purposes, like the fossil fuel industry. So my question is, how does one coalesce all this diversity to emphasize priorities that are obviously required in order to achieve anything really meaningful?
Yeah, well, let me just show you something. Energy, climate. There are ways to build coalitions that are broader than they might be otherwise. If you start to dig in behind some of the fights we're having over things like global warming. Let me just show you something. Okay. So, darn. You know what? I'll just tell you. It's on the blog. If you just Google for energy agreement lies behind climate disputes, you realize that libertarians and conservatives who I know want to create, like energy efficiency. They want to move away from dependence on foreign oil in the States in ways that end up aligning them with people who are really concerned about global warming. But it only happens if you start looking for ways to talk across some of those barriers who don't like subsidies. The Heritage Foundation hates subsidies, whether they're serving Exxon or anybody else. So finding places where you can start to have a conversation that crosses some of these divides, I think, is really important. And it's doable. And what I was going to show you reveals that pretty powerfully. And there's actually been some new work that shows the same thing. So energy efficiency, energy innovation. And another area is disaster resilience. If we move away from talking about climate adaptation to resilience to climate extremes, there are plenty of libertarians I know who hate the idea that in the United States we subsidize people building houses on floodplains that we know will be inundated in a hurricane. I have very conservative friends who feel just as outraged about that from a completely different reason than I do. Well, actually, not a completely different reason. You know, why is my money being spent to help someone build a house in a place where we know it's going to burn down or flood? So I find lots of opportunities to build conversations that can get across some of the gaps you were kind of implying. And I may not be getting at what you were thinking about, but I think a little bit.
Well, the only thing is it isn't happening enough. And that's my question.
Well,
How do we promote this coalition building?
Well, a lot of it comes back to the old environment. You know, most environmental disputes are fought out from the edges. You know, it's really partisan fights where the environmental outcomes aren't necessarily the thing people are trying to achieve. I shouldn't say that, but the environmental outcomes are secondary to the winning, losing parts of some of those fights, at least in the States. It's really, the polarization is mostly from the edges. And if you really dig in, you can start to see there are ways to move away from that. But it means giving up some of the old models of how we get stuff done.
Thank you. Regarding the environment, I'm always concerned about the population numbers. Yeah. To solve the environment will be a monumental task, of course, but I don't think we can solve it without tackling the population numbers. The curve you showed us a while ago, if we don't do anything about it, it just shoot off the chart. But even if we flatten it a bit like you were showing, what will happen then is that the economy will completely be disturbed, because right now our leaders are always after us to expand the economy, and this means expanding the population. But if the curve flattens, so you'll have some sort of stagnation or whatever it is, and I don't know if any economist can give us an answer to what will happen at the time. I don't know if you have the answer. I don't.
No, it's so interesting. I've been writing a lot about the population factor in this whole debate, or in the formula for. I just got to show you something funny. And I've periodically the thing that I've become more and more aware of is that consumption really is the thing that matters the most. When I speak about this, I've said. Imagine the difference between a world of 9 billion people living a Las Vegas lifestyle and 9 billion vegan monks. And when I use that phrase, a population group got, they're like, you know, Andy, they kind of punished me. There's a really funny drawing of it. Oh, I got to show you. Oh, here we go. Has anyone seen this? Well, you'll see it now. So that's they're saying Andy Revkin, you know, not even 9 billion vegan monks is still a problem. I just think it's hilarious. but I do think that it's the consumption factors that really matter the most. I've written innumerable pieces about the importance of family planning access, making sure women have the possibility of having a family the size that she wants, is especially in places that are vulnerable to environmental hazards, like sub-Saharan Africa, is vital. But it's still more about how much stuff than about how many people. I mean, we can talk more about that. And I came from a very population-focused background.
No matter what you do, the population keeps on increasing.
We'll see what happens. I'm going to spend some time this summer at IASA, IIASA. It's a place in near Vienna that does a lot of long-term modeling. Like they see lots of scenarios that head toward the year 2300 with like 2 or 3 billion people, and not through a calamity, not through some great breakdown, but just because of the normal way we're going to evolve. They're not saying it's probable. They're just saying it's possible.
So you mentioned the day after tomorrow.
Yeah.
And I'm curious how you view narrative and storytelling in convincing people to change their ideas about environmental problems like anthropogenic climate change. And I hosted a panel with a bunch of science fiction writers, one of whom was Kim Stanley Robinson, who's written extensively about problems in climate change from a fictional point of view. And we had huge arguments about how faithful science fiction needed to be in its facts versus creating a dramatic storyline and what would convince people to change.
Well, I think most of what you're talking about is envisioning futures.
Mm-hmm.
And it's vital. If you want to change the picture from what seems to be where we're heading, if you're not envisioning, like the landscape I showed you for New York City, you start with some designs. Like, well, you know, in a geophysical way, this would really make a lot of sense. But then you step back and say, what would the society have to be like that would be willing to move away from the we will not retreat story to a story that could generate that kind of softer landscape without maybe a hard knock? And so I think all those exercises are vital. I mean, and that's what fiction. I've been thinking. I haven't written a book since 2006, and There is a novel in, I've been thinking about, although I'm not sure I'm skilled enough to write it, but I should partner with Kim Stanley Robinson. I think it's really important to do those exercises. Whether that changes things, I don't know. There's been some scholarly work on, even on Day After Tomorrow, there were some peer-reviewed papers on, did that modulate how people thought? Gasland, the movies can change people's views. The Cove, the one on the dolphins slaughter. Those are documentaries. They're opinion documentaries, but they're not fictional. But if we're not experimenting with those ideas, I think we're missing opportunities. I don't know if that helps.
Yeah, but it is interesting that we live in a world in which people will say on the one hand, facts, 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 but then they get moved by stories. And even when you look at the scenarios that were built from out of the IPCC, there are a lot of scientists who are enormously uncomfortable with that, with having stories as a part of those documents.
Oh, I know. Oh, you mean the science community.
The science community, I mean, you have to move all of these bodies.
Well, this gets back, Dan Kahane, the guy at Yale who did all that, he has been writing a lot about the science of science communication, and it is really important to understand, to dig in on the behavioral work that shows you what will and what doesn't matter, move in people embracing an idea or not. He still hasn't articulated perfectly the menu for getting it right, but I think a lot of scientists are like a lot of journalists who grew up thinking that knowledge, that's just an empty bucket out there, you fill the bucket and everything happens. The more people can get over that idea and start to explore this other work, the behavioral work, and to think about story, the better off we'll be. Another, just one last quick thought. Randy Olson, who used to be a marine biologist and became a filmmaker, he wrote a book called Don't Be Such a Scientist, which is about how to communicate science. His big thing now is story structure. Google for Randy Olson and the letters ABT, which he got from the guy who created South Park. In a documentary about South Park, the animated show, he said once, when you replace an and with a but or a therefore, you're telling a story. Like, and I went to the market and I bought some eggs and I came home and I cooked an omelet. That's not a story. I went to the market and I reached for my wallet, but I realized it wasn't there anymore. And I turned to the person next to me, but she was holding a gun. Or, you know, then you're telling a story. So he says there's some very simple things like that, at least to get people engaged in what you care about, are really vital. And most of us aren't really even attuned to that. So that's another level. That's more of a practical level of what you're talking about. Thanks. I'd love to talk more about this. Get in touch if you want to.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. Hi, I think I'm going to follow on this thought of communicating science notions. Could you speak to risk, and risk not as it exists in the world, but as it's perceived by people on their computers, seeing something go by and going, oh my God, right? So they were fine, and then they saw this thing on YouTube, and now they're like deeply concerned. I was in Calgary the other day talking about fracking to some students, and I said, you know, were you worried about fracking before you heard about fracking? No. But now you're like really, really, really concerned. What I am thinking about is how does that then influence what then becomes policy decisions and stuff like that?
Because
all of a sudden politicians are now, oh shit, you know, everything was fine until people started tweeting about it, but now it's become this big policy issue. Whereas in the world, like in the world outside of our minds, it may not be a valid policy issue. So
yeah,
if you could just talk to...
Well, you've hit on a lot of things there. To me, my biggest learning moment on risk came from reading Paul Slovic, who's a sociologist at Oregon State, who, like two decades ago, he wrote a book called The Feeling of Risk, which is real. I mean, this idea, the idea that we are rational about risk, that we are quantified in the way we approach it, is just such fantasy. And his book is about, his thinking, his research has all been about that risk is mostly feeling. It's not rational. And I'm sure many of you, recently with the vaccination stuff, you see people, if you pummel someone who's anti-vaccine with more and more science about vaccines, it just reinforces their predisposition. It doesn't change their mind. So all I'm saying is that whole arena is just very laden, and understanding that it's about feelings and not data is step one toward at least grappling with it in a realistic way. It's just, because it's just as mind-bending as what I was saying about science generally. It's really something. I just want to end with one quick thing. There were I also sing. So, while you're going out, you can listen to my song, Liberated Carbon. I didn't bring my guitar. I should have, and we were in a rush. But I got to play with Pete Seeger for 20 years off and on, and I write my own songs a lot. There was one that he really liked called Liberated Carbon, and here it is. So thank you again very much. And if you want to stay or listen, that's fine. Thank you. It's on YouTube.